Well, that's what I said. I still understand. That sounds like what Jim said, the spirits are coming back with Jesus. You meet new bodies that are coming up, you know, they're going to go or something. I mean, it does say rise.
In some way, the resurrection is a resurrection of the old body, but it's a recreation. It's a continuation of identity, but it's not a continuation of substance.
See, it seems like they almost, it's hard to reconcile them because how can is it being risen or is it being recreated? What does the word say?
There's no more problem than the person who died 2,000 years ago, there's nothing there to recreate.
That's a good point.
I think that the language is spatial, but I think that it's just the best, it's the closest the language can come to teaching us a concept of where we can't figure out simply, we just don't know what it is. Yes, we're going to come in
now. Are we going to agree on that opinion?
Why, Barbara and Lydia have questions already. take a deep breath. I said I was comfortable with the view that the man of sin, 2 Thessalonians 2, was what people see. But that the term Antichrist doesn't apply, except it had traditions but not biblical.
We don't have a church for the Lord anymore.
Paul says we ask from the body to confess with the Lord, doesn't he?
You preach that for a while.
I was all year from now.
Why not avoid the text?
Yeah, that's
my point. Avoid the text.
Oh my God.
Number one.
Wait a minute. You got to get our paper. I
got to
get a
sheet
of paper.
We all wait until the gentleman gets a sheet of paper. Futurist. Who's the Jesuit futurist? 5, name the two books and their authors that more than any others have popularized dispensationalism in America. Name the two books and their authors, more than any two, which have more than any others have popularized, meaning popular among the people. Be redundant. Popularized, might be.
What do you mean?
Spread among people.
You said two books?
Name the source of the theory of the two-stage coming, 6. Name the source of the theory of the two-stage coming. With the idea that there's two coming, the rapture and the revelation comes for the same thing, comes with the same. Where'd that idea come from? True or false? Dispensationalism holds to the secret rapture of the saints from among the wicked. True or false? Dispensationalism holds to the secret rapture of the saints from among the wicked. Great. In the term, quote, parenthesis church, end quote. What is the significance of the word parenthesis? The giving. What is the Reformation identification of Antichrist? What's the traditional Reformation identity, identification of the Antichrist? As they use that term. Number 10. Which of the major views that we examine affirms that the church is the fulfillment of the prophecies concerning the Messianic Kingdom? Which of the major views that we discuss affirms, which view affirms, that the church is the fulfillment of the prophecies concerning the Messianic Kingdom? Or the church is the Messianic Kingdom? Which of those views affirms that the church is the Messianic Kingdom? Got anyone repeated?
Three.
Some of the early church fathers were dispensationalists. True or false?
Five.
Name the two books on any others which have popularized dispensationalism in America. Two. All premillennials are dispensationalists. the major views of terms of the church of the Messianic Kingdom of Prophecy. I will give the answers. Those who do not agree with my answer, the wailing wall is to my right, your left. You may arrange your garments. Appreciate not putting dirt on your head because it makes my janitor ask us to. True or false? Number one, postmillennialism is no longer a well represented view of eschatology. Number two, all premillennialists are dispensationalists. What if they've been the other way around? All dispensationalists are premillennialists, but all premillennialists are not dispensationalists. That is, all dispensationalists hold 200,000 year reign on earth. That's what millennialism is. But, no, not dispensationalists. All dispensationalists, do y'all see that? All dispensationalists are premillennialists. But there is historic premillennialism as opposed to modern dispensationalists.
And yet, every dispensationalist believes that Jesus will be in the secret rapture before
the there are many who believe that Jesus will reign for 1,000 years on earth, but do not accept the dispensationalist control definition. But all dispensationalists accept the idea of premillennialism. The answer is false. Let me tell you. Three. Some of the early church fathers were dispensationalists. False. There's no such thing as dispensationalism until Darby. Some were modified premillennialists. You should know. You should learn that, because dispensationalists often try to suggest that the early church fathers were dispensationalists. That is absolutely not true. Remember, I discussed historic premillennialism as opposed to dispensationalism. God had many plans of salvation and many comings and many judgments. And all that. That's not what the early church fathers said. Okay. Number four, name the Jesuit scholar. And they did not, we don't know what all of the early church fathers said. Name the Jesuit scholar as the originator of the future view of eschatology. Rivera. Gesundheit Rivera. Spell R-I-V-E-R-A. Number five. Name the two books that millennia has popularized dispensationalism in America. Scofield Reference Bible. Jesus is Coming by Blackstone. Well, you got the books. Give yourself 5 points for the books and 5 points for the office, I guess.
What
about
late grade?
That point. Couldn't it be like 2 minutes?
No, it's always popularizing for that.
What was the question?
Name the two books when any others popularized dispensationalism in America. The time late grade was written, it's already done. Yes, I can. No. That didn't pop it right. That was that did not pop it right. Yes. I taught that yesterday. Jesus is coming. No, it has to be Jesus is coming.
I had a second edition.
I'm giving y'all the answer. Read it according. Name the source of the theory of the two-stage coming. Martin McDonald is the source. I'll give you credit for that. What was her? What group was she connected?
Irvingites.
The Irvingites, the early 19th century charismatic movement.
Give credit for Irving.
Daniel? No. McDonald, yes.
He was credit for Irving?
No.
How about Irving by way of Margaret's prophecy?
The answer has to be Margaret McDonald, or Ian McDonald. Old McDonald's daughter.
Or Al McDonald's.
Or McDonald's sister. Yes, Jack. Yeah, let's have a dumb one. Hey, you guys, this is college. What's going on? I feel like I'm in the eighth grade at school, yes.
Yeah, my name's Luck, but they love to call me Jack.
This is the generation going to save the world. The world's in a lot of trouble.
Give me a lot of fun, though.
Number seven. The wall solid ground here. True or false? Dispensationalism holds with the secret rapture of the saints from among the wicked. Number eight. Explain the significance of the term parenthesis church. The answer is exclusively, permitting none other. The answer must contain the fact that, the idea that, the church is not in the prophets. It does not contain that. It is W-R-O-N-G-E. Wrong number. Hey, wrong number, daughter. The answer must reflect the fact that parenthesis means not in the prophets. I will accept not in the prophets. I will accept absent from the prophets. Oh, number nine. Oh, did you say not in the original plan? Yeah, I accept that. Why don't you just put the simple explanation, Thomas? Why do you have to make it hard for me?
Can we use the church among the nations, the Jews, or this church?
No. Number nine. Here's the gimme. What is the Reformation identification of Antichrist?
Mickey Mouse.
Pope. The papacy. I'll accept the Pope. I'll accept the papacy. I'll accept Papa. Dad. It was better when I told it. Which of the major views, which of these major views affirms that the church is the fulfillment of the prophecies concerning the Messianic Kingdom? Amillennialism. And I'll have mercy on the spelling.
What is the proper spelling?
A-M-I-L-L-E-N-N-I-A-L-I-S.
Altogether?
Is it altogether? It's got a high connection. One word. Okay. Give yourself 10 points for each one correct. Put the score at the top of the page and hand them in. Now that was a fair test, but fine. Yes.
Was number 5 10 points?
There will turn on.
No, everybody's
talking about the book. No, take my heart. Rock it off without me in, but the Lord has come by the rest of the rock. Oh, my Lord.
All right, let's stop enjoying ourselves in that fight. We continue. We are looking at the prophecies which furnish the foundation of the hope of Israel. Do you understand what's going on? There's a certain body of prophecy containing key prophecies which the Jews look for, and which the modern eschatology looks at, as the major prophecies, the substantive prophecies, the foundational prophecies which make up the Messianic hope, the hope of Israel. One of these is the lion promises to the patriarchs. The ancients didn't use it, but the modern dispensationalists do. The idea is that God promised the lamb to the descendants of Abraham forever. That promise has never been kept. Therefore, modern Israel has a theological right to the lamb. And we pointed out yesterday that the Bible clearly teaches, categorically states, on several occasions, that promise has been kept. Yes. Well, yes. What are the basic promises? And we discussed the land promises. Sort of categories of promises. Rings in that way. Well, the second category are restoration prophecies. That is, the promises of the restoration of Israel. At a time when Israel was under foreign domination, in captivity, some in exile, most not, God promised to the prophets that there would come, that the nation would be restored. Hosea 1:10 is an important restoration prophecy. And loomed very big in the minds of the Jews. What had happened was that, the restoration of Israel. The restoration of Israel. Look at verse 7, Hosea 1:7 and following. But I will have compassion on the house of Judah, and deliver them by the Lord their God, and will not deliver them by bow, sword, battle, horses, or horsemen. I'm going to deliver Israel, but I'm not going to rescue them with a military expeditionary force. When she had weaned on Ruchamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said, name him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. This is the case, this is parallel to Emmanuel, isn't it? The name of the child of a prophet has prophetic significance. Is the vehicle of a prophetic message. Are you with me? So with Hosea.
What are you on, A or C?
I'm on A. So far, I'm venturing my way down the page. See what's going on? Because God, Israel, and Judah had turned their back. Israel and Judah turned their back on God. And said, in effect, we don't want to be his people. He said, okay, now you are not my people. That is, you are fallen from grace, as it were. And so now this is what you are. Lo-Ami, which is, if you know Hebrew, lo is the Hebrew negative, meaning no or not. Am is the Hebrew word for people. Ami means my people. Simple Hebrew. Lo ami, not my people. And I'm not your God. Okay, that's how things are now. You're in disgrace. Yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered, and it will come about that in the place where it was said, where it is said to them, you are not my people, it will be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. And the sons of Judah and the sons of Israel will be gathered together, and they will appoint for themselves one leader, and they will go out from the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel, indicating in the place where they were defeated, they shall win victory. This poetic language, figurative language. Well, this, so this chapter 2 starts out, say to your brothers, Ami, that is, my people. And now, this prophecy is a key restoration prophecy. What did it mean? In the day in which it is, or in the place, I mean, speaking of Jerusalem, in Jerusalem it is being said, we are not the people of God, but the day is coming when I'm going to restore and bring together both Israel and Judah, and on that day it will be said, Ami, you are my people. The nation is going to be restored. Restored in what sense? Well, fundamental question, restored in a political, national sense, or spiritually restored in the Messianic kingdom? Okay? That's the question. Now, the Jews, in their concept in the first century of the hope of Israel, said what? Which of the two? Spiritual restoration or national restoration?
National
restoration. And if you took this in a hyper-literal way, that's what it says, doesn't it? The question is that the way it's intended to be interpreted? Well, what does the New Testament say? Well, let's look at Romans 9 and down to see now, Jim. Romans 9, 24 through 27. Let's see how the Apostle Paul, who cites this verse, let's see how he uses it. Romans 9, 24 through 27. By the way, the point in Romans 9 is, another points, Israel, by the way, this is a very important chapter. I'll do some teaching now, parenthetically, but this is what college is for. Romans 9 is a key chapter in the history of theology because all of Calvinism, if you take my church history course, you understand what Calvinism. All of Calvinism, by the way, is based directly or indirectly on Romans chapter 9. Calvin's theology, basically, is one which was constructed by misinterpreting Romans 9 and then interpreting the rest of the New Testament teaching on salvation on the basis of this misinterpretation of Romans 9. Romans 9 is the great predestination chapter. And, for instance, it, look at verse 18. So then he has mercy on whom he desires, and he hardens whom he desires. You will say to me then, why does he still find fault? For who resists his will? On the contrary, who are you, O man, who answers back to God? The thing molded will not say to the molder, why did you make me like this? Or does not the potter will it? Or does not the potter have the right over the clay to make from the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for common use? What if God, although willing to demonstrate his wrath and make his power known, endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction? He did so in order that he might make known the riches of his glory upon vessels of mercy which he prepared beforehand for glory. Now, did God predestine some to be elect, some to be reprobated, go to hell? And who are we to say? Now, this was Calvin's starting point. He studied his theology. So he put a certain interpretation on this, and then he interpreted the rest of the New Testament teaching on salvation on the basis of his interpretation of Romans 9. An author has picked up on this and talked about this is Shank in his book, Electing the Sun. Points this out. Now, the fundamental mistake that Calvin made was that Romans 9 is not teaching, is not talking about eternal salvation. What's going on in Romans 9, and I'm laying the groundwork for our I'm not off the subject, I'm approaching the subject. Romans 9, what's going on is this. The book of Romans, as you know, is about fellowship. The Jews were not accepting the Gentiles were not accepting the Jews, and the book of Romans is the explanation of why they ought to accept one another, the basic reason being because God has, that men, there is one people now, there is no distinction. That's the key phrase in the book of Romans. There is no distinction. There is no difference. And that everybody is the same, Jews and Gentiles. They have the same problem, that's sin. They have the same solution, that's the grace of God. And there is no distinction. This is like a trip hammer all through the book of Romans. Okay? Okay. Calvin said that this predestination, this predestining some for glory and some for wrath, was talking about salvation. Salvation of the soul. And that's true only indirectly. I'm telling you what Romans 9 is really about. I'm taking a shortcut here. Are you with me? This is what this is what the book of Romans is all about, with some great parentheses. You know, you call some whole chapters or parenthetical discussions, but the main movement is, this is why, for instance, it starts out, there's no distinction. The gospel is the power of God to salvation to everyone. That's the key word of the book of Romans. Glance back at the conclusion. You look at Romans 15, the end of the book, Romans 15, 7. Wherefore, what does it say? Accept one another. For the doctrine. Accept one another, just as Christ also accepted us through the glory of God. Okay? So he's given them reasons why they ought to accept. Well, the Jews, the reason they weren't accepting the Gentiles is the Jewish Christians were making the old claim to national glory, and that was this, that we have a special place in the mind of God. That God had, and the Jews, there are many that have made good dispensationalists. They had not shed themselves of this hope, this false concept of the hope of Israel. Here's what they were arguing. Well, now, the Jews have a special promise because they have been the special people of God, and God promised to save Israel. And Paul corrects that. He says, no, God promised to save the remnant of Israel. And he points out that the salvation is not by race. Now, it has never been. They say, I'm a Jew because I'm of Abraham's descent. And he says, that's not what a real Jew is, and it never has been. Those who are real Jews in the mind of God are not those who are Abraham's flesh, but of Abraham's faith. Well, then the Jews were saying, well, now, wait a minute. God used us all these years, all these generations, for all these reasons. Therefore, he has to save us. And the argument in Romans 9 is that that's not true. Just because God used somebody, an individual or a nation, does not mean that he is obligated to therefore grant eternal salvation to them just because he used them. And he uses the classic example of Pharaoh. He used Pharaoh for his own purposes in the birth of the nation of Israel, right? But that did not get Pharaoh off the hook as far as judgment was concerned. And so the argument is, God used Pharaoh, but was not thereby obligated to save him. And God used the Jews as a nation, but is not therefore obligated to save them. In the same way that and you cannot make that obligation binding on God, in the same way that a piece of pottery cannot make obligations binding upon the potter. Y'all see that? Very interesting art. But so the issue is not, he's not talking about what Calvin said he was talking about. He was saying, as a matter of fact, that God can work out a plan which does not give special national preference to Israel, even though he did use Israel in the past. He is not obligated. He can do what he chooses. It's not the same thing that Calvin was saying at all. Well, that's the general context. Now, and so, but the Jews were, again, he's answering this objection to the Jews who were saying he used us as a nation, therefore he has to save us. Look at verse 22 now. What if God, although willing to demonstrate his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, that is, the nation of Israel. And they are, and they prepared for destruction, all right, because they rejected the Messiah. He did so in order that he might make known the riches of his glory upon vessels of mercy, which he prepared beforehand for glory. Even us, whom he has called, not from among the Jews only, but also from among the Gentiles. He says, God prepared this great plan of salvation. He used the Jews. Well, he doesn't have to save them because he used them. To prepare this great plan of salvation, which brings together Jews and Gentiles. As he also says in Hosea. Now here we are. And then he cites the verses which we just read. I will call those who are not my people, and her who is not beloved, beloved. That's Loruchamah. Not love. And it shall be in that, in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they shall be called the sons of the living God. Now, what's the point? Well, the point is this verse is given an application which is not national restoration. In fact, he says this, he uses it to prove that the Gentiles are included. It's interesting. As a, rather than far from it being a case in which he is promising a Jewish world empire, exclusively Jewish kingdom, Paul uses this prophecy to prove that all along, God had in mind a plan of salvation that would include the Gentiles. The way he says, even us, whom he also called, not from among the Jews only, but also from among the Gentiles, as he says also in Hosea. Point, yes.
So without this, what Paul's explanation of the chapter of Hosea's passage, you would only think it's for the Jews and not for the Gentiles, right?
I'm sorry, say it again.
Without Paul's explanation of the Hosea passage, then you can say that it wasn't for Gentiles, it was only for the Jews, because he didn't say in Hosea that it was specifically for, or it was for Gentiles, or for Gentiles also, it was only for Jews.
Well, it's interesting. Here's what the point is, I'm having to say, the point is, in Hosea, it says, you are not my people. What did a person become if they were not the people of God? It's interesting that the Jews became Gentiles. Became non-Jews. That's what Lo-Ami meant. That is, the nation of Israel had become Gentiles in the mind of God, at least in a figurative way, and that they, when they became not his people, they literally became not his people. They became Gentiles. And they can be restored by becoming a part of the Israel of God. That is, the promise, Lo-Ami, the Lo-Ami promise, what he is saying is this. And this is the application. Now listen to me, this is the application that Paul gives us. Let me tie things together for us now. The national dispensational view of that verse is this, that it is national restoration. That the Jews are going to be restored to their former Davidic glory. You know what I mean? There was a glory that happened under David. We understand from Paul's interpretation of it, which we could know by taking the prophecy seriously, that is not what the prophecy meant at all. What it meant was that because of the great sin of Israel, he cast them off, and they became Lo-Ami. They became not my people. They became Gentiles. And all they had to look forward to was a day when God would call all people universally into the Messianic kingdom. And at that time, all Gentiles, which included the nation of Israel, into his kingdom. But in this sense, in this poetic way, and Paul just nails him with it. Don't have this fancy. You see, the Jews were saying, well,
National Israel has a special promise. God has used us. We are his chosen people. He can't classify us with those Gentiles. See? And he's writing to that on that very point. He cites this prophecy, and what he's saying, of course, is this. Look, let's come down off our high and mighty. Let's accept one another, as he says in Romans 15. Why? Because as far as the relationship, you talk about your flesh, your nation, all you want to. Talk about how much God used you, but spiritually, as far as your relationship to God in eternity is concerned, you're all Gentile. Anybody in fellowship with God. But in Christ, lo ami, who includes Jews and Gentiles alike, lo ami becomes ami in Christ only. And therefore, he just dismisses with a sweep of this prophetic broom the whole range of national prejudice and pride of the Jews. He said, we're Jews. And he said, did you hear what the prophet said? You are not Jews. You're not Israel. You are lo ami. Not my people. So he calls not only from among the Jews, but also from among the Gentiles. Who are the Gentiles? Lo ami, not my people. Are you with me now? Yes.
Who are the Jews then? If the Jews weren't my people, then who are the Jews?
You see, the whole point he makes a national. You see, my point now, this is a very important, has a severe eschatological implications. You see, the genius of the Jewish national hope of the first century, which had Paul in chains, and the genius of dispensationalism and much premillennialism is this, that God does not have one people, he has two people. He has spiritual Israel, the church. He has national Israel. And the book of Romans absolutely demolishes that. The book of Romans says there is no distinction. That not only can a Jew today not say, because I'm of Abraham's faith, flesh, that gives me a special standing before God. He says it's not true now, and it never was. They are not all Israel who are Israel. He was saying that as far as salvation is concerned. You see, as far as God using a people, fair enough. He'll use who he wants to use. He'll use Pharaoh, he'll use the Jews. Doesn't get them off the hook. But as far as salvation is concerned, the Jews never did have a special standing with God. Because they were Jews, they had a special standing with God only if they walked by faith. And so that's true now, but it's always been true. They are not Abraham's, they are not of Abraham or of Abraham's flesh, they are of Abraham or of Abraham's faith. So he's saying, so then what they were saying was, we have a special chance, we have a special plan of salvation, we have a special standing with God, because we are Jews. He said, no you don't, and you never did. You never did. Fundamental mistake. You see, the Old Testament was always, even though it was in the context of the Mosaic sacrifice, the Jews taught salvation by works. The Old Testament never taught it. The Old Testament taught salvation by faith all along. And so the question is not, what is your flesh? The question is, what is your faith? It's always been the question. See, the Jews were wrong. They were categorically wrong. And when he says, and so he's saying, well, even Hosea said, when you turned your back on God, you became Gentiles, and your only hope. So that there is no distinction. You see what he's saying? There is no distinction. Book of Romans is saying, there is no distinction. There is no distinction.